Chapter 7, Questions and Answers. Question. Have Buddhist mantras incorporated sound symbols from other traditions? Answer. It seems that in medieval times in India, let's say from the 3rd to the 11th century of the Common Era, there was a sort of twilight zone which was not exactly Hindu and not exactly Buddhist. In that zone, there are a lot of mantras around, mantras that were used in connection with the worship of ethnic divinities and the performance of magic rites. In other words, mantras used for more or less mundane purposes. Some of these mantras were definitely taken over by Buddhists and spiritualized. You find a lot of them, with their associated visualizations, in the Buddhist tantras, especially in Tibet. So no doubt Buddhism did take over a lot of material, not exactly from Hinduism, which hardly existed in the modern sense in those days, but from the Indian ethnic religion and folklore. It's rather as if Christianity, on coming to the West from Palestine, had incorporated the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses, the village sprites, and so on. In a sense, of course, it sometimes did. Mythological figures do appear, heavily disguised, as Christian saints, or sometimes not so heavily disguised. Some saints just had the names of pagan gods with saint put before them. Saint Dionysus, for instance. Question. So is it possible to trace a historical development of Buddhist mantras? Answer. I doubt it very much, for the simple reason that we do not have the information to do it. Don't forget that Indian history, including religious history, is very poorly documented indeed. Question. How is it that mantras can spark off a particular quality? Do they just gather around them a number of associations, or is there something in the mantra itself, or is it impossible to say? Answer. It is probably impossible to say exactly what happens, but there is no doubt that each mantra has a very special, almost indefinable quality, which is quite distinctive and recognisable. You could try to see what happens when you recite a mantra, especially one you have not recited before. Question. In contrasting the myth of the return journey and the parable of the jewel and the lotus, you talk about how the guru chooses either the sudden or the gradual approach, depending on the temperament of the pupil. Is it useful for us to think in these terms? Answer. No, I think that such terms can be misleading and I no longer use them. To paraphrase Hui Neng's words in the Platform Sutra, there is no such thing as the quick path and the slow path. It is simply that some attain enlightenment more quickly than others. Some practice more intensively than others, and therefore cover the same psychological and spiritual ground more quickly. Sometimes people understand the short path to mean a path that somehow cuts out all the long and difficult preliminary stages, but that is wishful thinking. All the stages must be traversed, because they are determined by the very conditions under which development of any kind takes place. You can't make a growing plant jump certain stages of development, but by giving it extra nourishment, you may cause it to grow more quickly. Question. Have any of your teachers used the southern method with you, confronting you with ultimate reality? Answer. I don't think that any of my teachers ever deliberately and consciously confronted me with an ultimate truth. Perhaps their methods were more subtle than that. Indeed, the matter is more subtle than it perhaps appears to be. Ultimate truth, after all, can be presented in any terms. You are presented with it every moment of your life. When you change the flowers in your room because you see that they are faded, you are confronted with the ultimate truth of impermanence. Sometimes, of course, life presents us with situations in which we are more likely than usual to confront ultimate truth. It confronts us when we are bereaved or suffer some other dreadful loss, when our health is seriously affected, when we suddenly realize something unpleasant about ourselves for the first time, or see that we have been tormenting ourselves about something unnecessarily. Question: have you ever used the sudden method yourself? Answer: well, I have sometimes put a certain point to somebody or brought them up against a certain fact about themselves a little more sharply than usual. You do have to be quite careful, because some people take things very seriously, and a few words spoken quite lightly and casually can have a devastating effect. If you do feel that you have said something quite clearly, but quite gently, to someone a number of times, and they don't seem to have grasped the point, you may need to put it a little more strongly or directly. It depends on how well you know them and what degree of confidence they have in you. Question: I am struck by the contrast between the highly idealized visionary landscapes of the White Lotus Sutra's Pure Land, with the flat land, the dual trees, the golden cords, and so on, with the concrete nature imagery of much Chinese and Japanese art and literature, where mountains, lakes, and natural incidents like frogs jumping into ponds become central subjects. Do these differences spring from different levels of cultural experience, from different temperaments, or from cultural differences? Answer: you are speaking of one particular type of Chinese and Japanese art. There is another kind which endeavours to illustrate the Pure Land quite literally, with all the jewel trees and so on. I think the kind of art you are thinking of is distinctively a product of the Zen tradition. It's just a different way of looking at things, not necessarily more or less profound, but perhaps appealing to some temperaments more than others. Personally, I prefer the more literal representations of the Pure Land, with all the jewel trees and singing birds and gold and silver ornaments, which seem to have a more archetypal, for want of a better term, quality. Colours, especially jewel-like colours, do have a certain psychological and spiritual significance of their own. They do seem to give you some intimation of the higher, more archetypal levels of existence, something that the more naturalistic type of Chinese and Japanese art is really able to do. You could say that this naturalistic type of art tries to penetrate beyond the archetypal into the sphere of reality itself, and it can sometimes do that, but only in the hands of a very great artist who is also a Zen master. Otherwise it all falls rather flat. You have just got a picture of a nice little tree by a nice little stream with a nice little monk sitting underneath it on a nice little rock. That kind of art is rather hit or miss. Instead of going beyond the archetypal plane into the transcendental, it sometimes falls short even of the archetypal. Question: is it significant that it is Purna, who is renowned for his eloquence, who will be the Buddha of this world once it is purified? Could the sutra be saying that what this world needs more than anything is people who are eloquent in the teaching of the Dharma? Answer: this reminds me of something written by Dr. Ambedkar, the leader of the ex-untouchables in India, who led their conversion to Buddhism. Writing about the decline of religion, he said, in effect, that a religion will decline if it doesn't have universally valid principles, or if it doesn't have simple principles that can be easily explained to a lot of people. Then, he went on to say, a religion will decline if it doesn't have eloquent and capable preachers. Your principles may be as universally valid as you like, they may be as simple as you like, but you will still need human beings to put them across. No doubt the word eloquent is not to be taken too literally. The point is to be able to communicate effectively, whether the language you use is flowery or simple. Unless you have preachers, living human beings, who can communicate in this way, whether personally or through the books they write, Your principles, however universal and simple they are just not going to get across, and the religion will decline, or perhaps not even get started at all. So eloquence is needed in any world, certainly in any world in any way resembling our own, in which the Dharma is being propagated. Of course, there are other worlds where the Dharma is communicated by other means, through beautiful odours, for example. Question. You say that Om is the abstract universal, Hum is the concrete universal, and the jewel in the lotus shows how the abstract becomes concrete. Can you say a bit more about this? Answer. Well, an abstract universal is a universal which is a concept without any definite content, whereas a concrete universal is a universal which is not separable from its various particular instances and which expresses itself through them. These are terms of Hegelian philosophy which have passed into general currency to some extent. But perhaps we can approach it from a slightly different angle. For instance, take the concept of impermanence. When we first come across it, this is likely to be just an abstract universal as far as we are concerned. We accept it in theory, but we haven't yet embodied it in our lives. The more we actually embody it in all the different activities of our lives, the more concrete that particular universal becomes. Our realization of the concept of impermanence is transformed from a purely intellectual understanding into something which we understand through our actual experience. Of course, don't take this too literally. It is not that Om only represents an intellectual understanding. But at one level, the mantra does represent that type of transition. To use Buddhist terms, it is really a transformation of vijnana into jnana or pranya. Note, vijnana means consciousness. As one of the five skandhas, the five aggregates, which, according to Buddhism, make up psychophysical existence, vijnana is consciousness through the five physical senses and through the mind at various levels. Pranya means wisdom, the wisdom which arises when one sees that each of the skandhas, including vijnana, is empty of separate existence. The arising of this wisdom represents the transformation of bare awareness into spiritual understanding. As for the jewel and the lotus, these two between them fully represent the path, which is a process of the unfolding of potentiality through which abstract understanding is transformed into concrete realization. Question. Could the symbol also relate to the three levels of wisdom, hearing, reflecting, and meditating? Answer. Yes, indeed, because what you merely hear, what you know in the ordinary abstract way, is quite different from pranya, which is a matter of actual insight and realization. The intermediate stage is the stage of reflection, the stage of turning the knowledge over in your mind, incorporating it, making it your own. Question. You describe, at least in outline, the Avalokiteshvara visualization practice. I thought that such practices were generally not to be discussed with anyone who does not actually do the practice. Answer. Well, the description of the image is just like looking at a picture. It is not intended as an initiation or anything like that. It is just a conjuring up of an inspiring image and should be taken in that spirit. Any little details of the practice added just fill out the picture. Question. The particular practice you described involves visualizing yourself as Avalokiteshvara, but in some other practices one visualizes the Bodhisattva in front of one. Is there any principle behind this distinction? Answer. The broad principle to bear in mind is that inasmuch as your experience is bifurcated into a subject and an object, any spiritual practice that you do is conditioned by those limits. If you visualize, say, Avalokiteshvara as being outside yourself, that is only half the truth, or not even half the truth. You also have to visualize him within you. You have to visualize Avalokiteshvara as the subject as well as the object, and eventually you need to be able to bring the two together. Whether you start with the subjective pole or the objective pole is perhaps a matter of temperament, but there is both a subject and an object in your experience, and both have to be transformed. When you are visualizing Avalokiteshvara out there, you must remember that he is also in here. And when you are visualizing him in here, you must remember that he is also out there. This is the basic principle you need to bear in mind. Question: is it really a good idea to continue visualizing yourself as the Bodhisattva when you have finished doing the meditation practice? Might it not be a bit fanciful? Answer: well, if you haven't transformed yourself into the Bodhisattva in the course of the practice, it is bound to be fanciful. But there is nothing wrong with thinking of yourself as the Bodhisattva and trying to behave accordingly, even if you have not realized yourself as the Bodhisattva in the meditation. Whether it is advisable or not depends on the circumstances you are in. I think that it is only advisable to try to sustain the feeling that you are the Bodhisattva if your circumstances are very propitious. If you were to try it in your everyday life, it would probably set up too great a tension between what you were trying to do and the circumstances in which you were trying to do it.